This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Colin Powell has begun doing publicity for his new autobiography, My American Journey. And no one knows whether to cover his tour as a book promotion or the prologue to a presidential campaign. Colin Powell retired from the military 2 years ago after an illustrious career. He did 2 tours of duty in Vietnam and served in Korea and Germany. But he perhaps made his greatest mark in Washington. He worked in the Pentagon under President Carter. In the Reagan administration, he was top military aide to Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger and then National Security Advisor. In 1989, President Bush chose Powell to serve as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the president's top military advisor. Powell became the youngest officer and the first African American ever to hold the position. During the Gulf War, he rose to the status of celebrity and national hero. I spoke with General Powell this morning. General Colin Powell, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. Good to be with you this morning.
You're keeping America guessing about whether you're going to run or not. And, of course, the big rumor is that you intend to make your decision public right here on Fresh Air. Do I understand that correctly?
It's a rumor I've heard, and who knows? I'll have to make a decision as to where I do it. And I've heard so much about this show that you certainly are a candidate.
Oh, yeah. Well, you've recently revealed some of your views. I was reading a speech that was quoted in Time magazine in which you said, there isn't a single one of my friends from my days working in the West Wing who would tell you whether they think I'm a Republican or Democrat. That was part of the code I lived with. And I was wondering whether that means that you didn't have very deep feelings about issues and policies or whether you were just good at keeping those feelings concealed.
No, I have deep feelings, but they tended not to be politically ideologic feelings. You have to remember that I was a career military officer for my whole adult life, even beginning in my teenage years. And I live by a very, very stringent code, which says that a career military officer does not dabble in partisan politics. And I believed in that. And so throughout my life, as a concerned American citizen, I would listen to political debate, and then I would make up my own mind on the issues and on the candidates. And I would vote for the candidate that I thought was best for America. Thus, you will find in my history, I voted for both Democrats and Republicans. But I'm not an ideologue. I was an officer in the Army, and I never aligned with either of the two political parties and always considered myself an independent. And I even was able to hold this position 2 years working for Ronald Reagan in the West Wing of the White House.
You've revealed some of your views, and some of the views that you revealed are different from the Christian coalitions. You're against prayer in school, although you'd support a silent moment. You oppose abortion, but say it's really a decision between a woman, her family, her doctor. And you've said, I'm troubled by the political passion of those in the extreme right who seem to claim divine wisdom on political as well as spiritual matters. If you did run, what do you think you would? What do you think your posture would be toward the Christian coalition?
Well, what I would say to the Christian coalition is that I fully share the value system that you are presenting to the American people—a restructuring, a restoring of the family, a belief in marriage, a belief in life, a belief in a divine providence that put this nation and this people here. I congratulate the Christian coalition for sort of pulling us up short as a nation and pointing these things out to us again. But there are some positions that they have taken that I think go a little bit too far, and it is those positions that I have been presenting a counter to over the last few days, and I'm sure that is the Christian coalition would rather that I did not feel that way, but it is the way I feel. So what I'm trying to do now in this phase of my life is tell the American people what I think. I'm not trying to meet the position standards of any coalition, either on the right or on the left. And on the issues you mentioned with respect to abortion, I am not for abortion. I wish women would not face that choice, and I would hope that young men and women would act sexually responsible so that they would not bring into the world a child that they are not prepared to love and care for. But at the end of the day, I think a woman should be allowed the right to choose how she will use her body, and it's a choice she has to make and is allowed to make under the laws of our land in consultation with her own conscience, her partner in this matter, her family, and her God.
One of the areas of conflict that you had with President Clinton was over the use of force in Bosnia. And you felt that we should not use force force in Bosnia. The latest round of NATO airstrikes seem to have created something of a breakthrough. They appear to have gotten help get the parties to the table to negotiate. The Sarajevo airport is open. Other roads are open. Looking back, do you think that the use of force has been productive in Bosnia?
The use of force is always an option. And in my advice to both President Bush and President Clinton, I said that if you're going to use force, you have to have the use of that force linked to very, very clear political purposes. And once you have linked them to those purposes, then you should use force in a decisive way. A couple of years ago, when we were looking at this, my advice was to be very, very reluctant about entering this conflict with force, because the decision of NATO and the United Nations was that we would seek a diplomatic political solution and we were there for humanitarian aid, and you should be careful about becoming a belligerent. And that was the advice I gave, and it was advice that President Clinton received and then made his own judgments. What's happened in the last few months is a couple of things. One, a new diplomatic track led by America. I mean, I think President Clinton and Tony Lake and Warren Christopher, Secretary of State, did a very, very great job over the last couple of months in seizing the political initiative. And we now have an American-led diplomatic effort that is showing some progress. We also saw on the battlefield not just the use of air power, but I think even more significantly, Croatian ground action, which took back the Krajina, and we have seen the Croat and Muslim Federation showing more aggression on the ground and more success on the ground. And I think also the Serbians realize that they have what they really want at the beginning, a diplomatic solution that recognizes their right to a separate identity. And so I think many pieces are coming together, and not just the use of air power. The air power, I'm delighted to see, was used in a decisive, not a pinprick way, and it was used for a specific purpose to protect Sarajevo and the remaining safe areas. But ultimately, this war will be concluded because of a diplomatic breakthrough, and if air power has helped, that's fine. I'm not sure it would have had the same effect a couple of years ago, but I'm not prescient. I could be, you know, it could have.
General Colin Powell is my guest, and the occasion for his visit is the publication of his autobiography, My American Journey. General, I'd like you to describe the neighborhood you grew up in.
I grew up in a typical New York City neighborhood of the period 1940-1950. We were poor to lower middle-income families. For the most part, we were families. There was a mother and a father living in one of those tenement apartments. I thought I had a great childhood. You could play freely on the streets for a nickel. You could get on the subway or trolley car and travel all over New York City. And with a bicycle, the whole city was at your disposal as well. It was a very multi-ethnic neighborhood. As I've said in my memoirs, there was no white Anglo-Saxon Protestant mentality. We all were immigrants or minorities in one way or another. And we learned how to live together. It was a great deal of tolerance. It wasn't a perfect neighborhood. There were drugs, and drugs were becoming a major problem in the neighborhood at that time. There was violence, but it essentially involved occasional zip guns and switchblades, and not magnums and machine guns as we see now. And we had not yet experienced the deterioration. There were still jobs in New York. You could get on that subway, go downtown, and find a good job that would allow you to bring home enough money to support a family.
And what's your old neighborhood like now?
My old neighborhood, the block I was raised on is quite changed. The house I was raised in was burned out during the horrible drug period of the 70s when it really got bad, and that entire neighborhood was deteriorating, and it was essentially burned to the ground. But now there are new garden apartments on that side of my block, and there are people living there. It's showing some signs of rejuvenation. But there's a long way to go. There are too many single-parent families, too many women-only parent families. The school system is not what it could be, not as good a school system as it used to be in the old days. And we've got a long way to go before that neighborhood comes back. I walked those streets a few weeks ago, and we've got a long way to go.
My guest is Colin Powell. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Colin Powell. At your retirement ceremony, you said, "The Army has been my home, the Army has been my life. I am what I am because the Army takes care of its own." And in your memoir, you say that you found a home first in ROTC. What appealed to you about ROTC?
When I entered City College of New York, I was just short of my 17th birthday. Just barely a kid, a real kid, a teenager, just entering college quite early. And I really had no goal in life at that point. I was just a street kid. And after bouncing around college for 6 months, changing my major, still unsure, I came upon the ROTC program. I came upon a group of youngsters in a fraternity called the Pershing Rifles. And I was embraced by the warmth of that fraternity and ROTC. I liked the structure. I liked the discipline. I liked the uniform that made me distinctive. I was suddenly not just a block kid. I was somebody in a uniform. And it all appealed to me. And I fell in love with it at that point. It was a love affair with the Army that didn't even end upon retirement 2 years ago.
You describe yourself as never having been an athlete. Do I have that right?
Yes, I must admit that.
Athletics are often a proving ground for young men. Did the military give you an alternate proving ground?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I was very good at drill, and if put to the test today, I could still go out and form a platoon and put them through some very, very fancy drill. And in fact, last summer up in Rye, New York, at a reunion of my ROTC crowd, we did that in the parking lot, much to the distraction of the hotel guests who were trying to get in and out of the parking lot while all these 50-odd-year-old men were thumping around with their guts hanging around. But I could still do it. And so I was pretty good at that. I was pretty good at all of my other military subjects. And so I could excel there while I couldn't excel at basketball or running track or baseball or any of the more traditional sports of a young man.
You're the first chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to work his way up through ROTC as opposed to, say, West Point. Did you ever face any West Point snobism in the military?
In the early years of my career, the West Pointers were sort of looked up to. And at that time, you had great advantage as a West Point graduate to rise to the higher ranks. There was something of what we used to call the WPPA, the West Point Protective Association. But over the years of my career, that pretty much disappeared, and we all competed equally, regardless of the source of our commission. So you'll find now as many, in fact, more ROTC generals than you will find Academy generals and admirals. During the time I was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, of the six members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chairman, the vice chairman, and the four service chiefs, no more than one was an Academy graduate. All the rest of us were ROTC or direct commissioning of some kind.
In your memoir, you write, a certain ambivalence has always existed among African Americans about military service. Why should we fight for a country that for so long did not fight for us, that in fact denied us our fundamental rights? Did you ever feel that ambivalence yourself? And you served through the 60s in the Civil Rights Movement.
No, I never felt that ambivalence. I'm the heir of a proud legacy of black soldiers who went before me. The Buffalo Soldiers of the post-Civil War period, the Tuskegee Airmen that were getting some prominence now through film and their story being told. And what was put into me was that we served and sacrificed at a time when our nation was not prepared to serve us or sacrifice for us. But we made it. We got ahead. With each passing conflict, we demonstrated that we could do in combat just what our white brothers and sisters could do. And Powell, you were to take advantage of that. You were not to grind your teeth about it. Don't carry a chip on your shoulder. We did this to put you in the position you are now in, and you will not be forgiven if you don't take advantage of our sacrifice. And that's the way I always approached it.
Your first tour of Vietnam was late 62 and then through 63.
Mm-hmm.
And while you were in Vietnam that year, your wife was living in the city of her birth, Birmingham.
Yep.
And that was during a period of church bombings and when authorities were using fire hoses and police dogs to try to stop the civil rights movement. You're right, your father-in-law sat with a shotgun on his lap to protect his home and his family. Did you ever wish that you were fighting, that you were able to fight in the civil rights in the civil rights movement at home instead of having to fight in a war abroad that you became, a war you became increasingly disillusioned with as the years went on?
Yeah, much of what was happening in Birmingham and in the South during that period never penetrated into the jungles of Vietnam. There were no newspapers, there were no news broadcast. You would get some news every couple of weeks. And my father-in-law and my wife obviously tried to keep the worst of it from me so as not to cause me any problem. When I came home, I, of course, saw it in spades and learned about my father-in-law with his guns. And it disturbed me. And I was deeply committed to the civil rights movement, but the choice I had made at that point was to be a soldier and to work within the system and to do the best I could. And so, yeah, I guess there will always be a lingering feeling that I was enjoying the benefits of an integrated society while Jesse Jackson and Martin Luther King and Mr. Abernathy and Joe Lowery and John Lewis and all the other civil rights leaders were out there taking risks every day to make it a better country and also to make things better for me. But as I say in the book, we all had to serve in some way, and the way in which I served was to take advantage of the opportunities that were being created for me and to move ahead in line with those advantages and never, never forget that people sacrificed for me and never, never turn my back on my own heritage or origins.
How did the civil rights movement, which was challenging the establishment, the white establishment in the United States, affect challenges to authority in the military when you were there?
There were no direct threats. There were to our authority. There were difficult periods in the early 70s, right after the Vietnam War, where the turmoil and racism that were rampant throughout the country got into the military. We were always a product of our society. And you may recall, we were having mutinous situations on some of our aircraft carriers. Race relations within the military was not good. And we just buckled down as leaders in the military and said, listen, we cannot tolerate this within the military. There has to be discipline. There has to be high standards. But at the same time, we have to make sure that each and every person in the military feels that they are treated fairly, he and she are treated fairly, and that we have equal opportunity. We do create a level playing field. And if you are not prepared to fight and play in that level playing field, we will help you get up to standards. And so we took hold of ourselves in the early 70s, and we had affirmative action programs, we had equal opportunity programs, we had sensitivity training. We did everything we could to give all of our youngsters a sense of being equal, a sense of being family. And as a result of our commitment during that period, we came out of the mid-70s as the most integrated institution in American society with a model that is still being talked about, a model that we can be proud of.
How did you feel during the war in Vietnam when Martin Luther King started marching in anti-war demonstrations?
It troubled all of us. Martin Luther King was a hero to us. He was an icon. And we would have preferred that he had not shifted over to this political cause, the anti-war cause, that seemed to be part of the undercutting of what we were trying to do in Vietnam. And so it disturbed me, but at the same time, it did not disturb me to the point that I did not have the greatest admiration and respect for what Dr. King was doing.
General Colin Powell is my guest, and the occasion for his visit is his new autobiography, My American Journey. At what point did you start to become skeptical of the war in Vietnam?
When I first went over, arriving in Vietnam on Christmas Day of 1962 as an advisor, it was all charged up, a young 25-year-old captain there to stop communism, not truly understanding the roots of the conflict, the nationalist roots of the conflict. By the end of that first year of tromping through the jungle and watching our strategy at work, I started to sense that it was going to be a far more difficult task than we'd imagined, and it was a task that involved more than just stopping communism. We were supporting a regime in South Vietnam that did not really fit the model we had in mind of a democratic government. And we were fighting a very, very determined enemy. By the time I went back in 1968, the regime hadn't improved, and it was clear that we were fighting an enemy that was prepared to match us man for man and prepared to accept enormous suffering. And we were not prepared to suffer equally, and we were not prepared to use all the resources at our disposal to achieve a victory. And so there was a policy strategy mismatch. There was a mismatch in what we were trying to do militarily with what we were trying to achieve politically. And we all started to become disillusioned with the war at that time. And, of course, we saw that the American people were rapidly becoming disillusioned. And yet the war went on for another several years with many, many thousands of Americans killed.
What did it do to you, though, to be in the military at a time when you were disillusioned?
You have to remember that I was a career military officer, as were most of my colleagues, leading armies of mostly conscripts. We followed our government's instructions, not blindly. We were disturbed and we were troubled, but nevertheless, we were career officers, and it was our job to carry out the national policy given to us by our commander-in-chief, and which at that time was still being supported by the Congress, even though there was great distress within the American people. And so notwithstanding our concerns over this, we had an obligation to do the job that we had been given to do.
Without revealing your own skepticism.
We talked about it. We were skeptical. It's not that we didn't reveal our skepticism. It's just that our senior leaders, we thought, could see the war as we were seeing the war, and we continued to fight that war.
Colin Powell, he's written an autobiography called My American Journey. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. General Powell will be back with us in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with General Colin Powell, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His new autobiography, My American Journey, has just been published, and he's considering a run for the presidency. When we left off, General Powell had described why he eventually grew disillusioned with the war in Vietnam. Now, how do you think the Vietnam War shaped your strategy as a military advisor and then as chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
It had an impact, obviously. I think all of us who were in Vietnam came away, those of us who were going to stay in the military came away with a conviction that if we ever faced a crisis like this again, we had to make sure that our political leaders had thought through what they were trying to achieve. We had to make sure that we were part of that decision process, not for the purpose of sort of breaking down the separation between civilian and military authority, but to make sure that our political leaders understood the military implications of what they were thinking of doing. And then we had to be very, very candid with our leaders that when they had decided what it is they wished to accomplish as a political matter, and they wished to use force for part of the accomplishment of that, in addition to political, economic, and diplomatic means, they knew what it would take, and we didn't mislead them, and we didn't con them. And then if we decided to go ahead, then let's go in for the purpose of achieving a decisive result, to use the old-fashioned American word, win. So many of us were shaped by that experience and came out feeling that way. And it's not just Vietnam. I saw other things happen over the years, such as our intervention in Lebanon, in Beirut in 1983, which produced drastic, terrible results when we lost all those young Marines, where we meddled into something we didn't really understand and we weren't in there to do something decisive. And that shaped us. But I also have to say that even after we provide this advice to our political leaders can accept or reject that advice and may still feel it necessary to go forward with something that isn't as clean as we would like it to be, that is murky, in which case we've done our job, we've given our best advice, and then we should go ahead and do whatever our political leaders tell us to do. And that has always been the ethos of the American military.
You were described in the New Republic as the prototype of the political general, determined never to let themselves be drawn again into a politician's war, placing new emphasis on learning the rules of the game in Washington and playing it well. Do you agree with that description?
Oh, I've been characterized by many things. I'm not quite sure if a political general is a condemnation. It certainly isn't intended as a compliment. All I've tried to do over the years is to serve wherever I was assigned to the best of my ability. My field military credentials are clear. My first roughly 10 years of my life, I was doing nothing but serving in the field. And I have had political assignments over the years because people thought I did those rather well, and I did whatever I was asked to do to the best of my ability. It's not a never again mentality. It's a mentality that says we owe the American people and we owe our political leaders our best advice on how we go to war and how we use the lives of the sons and daughters of the American people. And if we don't provide that advice, whether it is welcome advice or not welcome advice, then we are not doing our job as senior military advisors to the president and stewards of the lives of the sons and daughters of the American people. That's what I tried to do. That's what my colleagues tried to do. And the political general title I'm stuck with, and I'm sure I'll get many more titles in the weeks ahead.
General Colin Powell is my guest. Let me ask you briefly about a controversial chapter of your Washington years, and this is when you were military assistant to Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger in the Reagan administration. This has to do with the arms for hostages deal. I believe you actually issued the secret memo authorizing thousands of missiles to be sent from the military to the CIA for shipment to Iran via Israel. Now, the way you describe it in the book, you didn't agree with the policy. Caspar Weinberger didn't agree with the policy, but you felt compelled to carry it out because President Reagan had authorized for that to happen. Did you ever consider saying no? Would that have been an option for you?
Not at that time, because what you're referring to is a considered decision made by the President of the United States. He had thought through the objections that he got from Secretary of Defense Weinberger and Secretary of State Shultz, and the President decided that he thought it was worth a try to trade TOW missiles, anti-tank missiles at that time, to the Iranians to see if he can encourage Iranian moderates and see if he could get the release of American hostages. The two cabinet officers, Shultz and Weinberger, and their assistants, me and many others both in the State and Defense Department, thought it was not a good idea and it wasn't great policy. But the President decided it. There was nothing illegal about it. There was nothing immoral about the policy. It was just a policy debate. And so it wasn't something, in my judgment anyway, to resign over. It was a legal action. And when Secretary Weinberger came back to the office that day in January of 1986 and said that the President has heard it all, but he has decided and signed a legal document that has been given to him and approved by the Attorney General, and we are now to execute it and provide, you take the action to provide TOW missiles to the CIA, which I did. It was not illegal at that time. What subsequently came out, the diversion of funds that were generated by the sale of those weapons, the diversion of those funds to purposes that were not approved by the American Congress and were not known to the President or the cabinet officers, that's what was illegal. But at the time the President made his decision, it was a policy dispute, but it was not a question of illegality.
Did you ever disobey an order in the military or in Washington?
I can't think of one that I disobeyed, because I don't think I ever received one that was either illegal or inconsistent with policy. The code of the military officer is to obey orders as long as those orders are lawful orders, and I don't ever recall receiving an unlawful order.
I want to skip ahead to the Gulf War. There's still debate over whether the war should have been continued a little longer, until the Republican Guard was decimated or until Saddam Hussein's regime was toppled. You say that after you told President Bush that the war could probably be wrapped up the following day, the President said, well, why not end it today? We're starting to pick up some undesirable public and political baggage with all those scenes of carnage. You say we've accomplished the mission, so why not end it today? Was the undesirable public and political baggage one of the main reasons for ending the war when it was ended?
It was certainly a consideration. I wouldn't call it the main reason. And what I said to the President that morning after talking to General Schwarzkopf earlier was that we are within the window of success, and sometime in the next 24 hours I'll probably be bringing you a decision to stop. And he said, well, if you believe that, and if General Schwarzkopf believes that, then why not stop it today? Not meaning right then, but sometime within this window of 24 hours. And what turned out to be the case, it was well past halfway into that window of 24 hours. And the reason we stopped it was, frankly, the Iraqi army was streaming out of Kuwait. We had accomplished the principal political purpose given to us by the United Nations and approved through a contentious resolution by the American Congress, and that was to kick the Iraqi army out of Kuwait. That was being accomplished. General Schwarzkopf had just given a briefing to that effect about the same time we were meeting in the Oval Office. It was clear we were going to be able to restore the Kuwaiti regime to power, and it was clear that we were going to have a different relationship with our friends in the region. So we thought we'd accomplished the political objectives given to us. The question was, were we going to be criticized for not having inflicted greater damage on the Iraqi army and the Republican Guard? And we knew we would probably receive that criticism, but the judgment that we made that day, a judgment that the President asked us about and which I made, and I stand by that judgment, and General Schwarzkopf does, is that what purpose would be served in killing more American and coalition youngsters, and what purpose would be served in killing more Iraqi soldiers who had been sent on a fool's errand by a fool? And 4 years later, as I've reflected on this many, many times, and as I've watched all of the commentary and critique, I have no second thoughts about that decision. The Iraqi army is not in Kuwait. The Kuwaiti government is. We have a much more stable relationship with our friends in the region. The Iraqi army has been on, and the Iraqi regime has been under sanctions for 4.5 years. The most they can do is sort of fluff around in the desert from time to time, but they are no strategic threat to their neighbors. And the Iraqi army is about 35% to 40% of their original size. I think it's a pretty good outcome. And I have to point out, we did this at the loss of 147 American lives. I wish we hadn't lost to one, but we did lose 147. And when you think of that time when people were expecting us to lose thousands and thousands, I'm proud of that outcome. And I run into many American families as I go around the countryside, and I'll run into many families and parents who come up to me and say, my child was in Desert Storm. We want to thank you guys for the way you handled it. You didn't waste life. That's enough. That's enough for me, and I can take all of the criticism that comes otherwise. It was a good war. We accomplished our purpose. We achieved it. We won it. We never had plans to march in Baghdad. We knew Hussein would probably survive. Regrettably, there was no way we could guarantee that outcome short of taking over Baghdad and Iraq, and that was not the mission we were given. So I stand by the decisions that were made. I just stand by the advice I gave and the judgments I presented to President Bush.
My guest is Colin Powell. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Colin Powell. General, you've titled your memoir An American Journey, and your book is really about achieving the American dream, which you certainly have. And I think the message you'd like to leave us with is that hard work is rewarded, and anyone through hard work can have the American dream. And surely you are Exhibit A. On the other hand, I'd say your parents offer just a slightly different picture in that they were incredibly hardworking from how you describe them, very good people. Your mother was a seamstress, your father a shipping clerk who rose to foreman. But their jobs didn't bring in enough to buy the house that they wanted in the suburbs. They bought the house when your father played the numbers and won. And, of course, the numbers are an illegal lottery. I'm not putting that down. But sometimes legitimate means for advancement are really limited.
Yeah, we were not suffering by living in the South Bronx. Mm-hmm. We had a wonderful apartment with 4 bedrooms, and it was a very, very comfortable life. But it was always a dream to move out to the suburbs. Now, whether my parents would have ever been able to do it on their salary, as some of my relatives had, remains to be seen. But I couldn't resist throwing in that somewhat charming story about how we leapt ahead. If we had not had that lucky win through an illegal action at the time, we would have continued to enjoy our life in the Bronx, but might have been a little harder to get out to the suburbs. My book, My American Journey, I think, is a description of the American dream, and it shows how a fairly ordinary person can excel in this country. It's my story, but it's a story that's repeated thousands of times every day in America. It's the history of America. And it's a story that we have to have repeated again and again in the future. And it has to also involve those Americans in inner cities, such as I came from, who are beginning to lose faith and beginning to wonder if the American dream is for them.
Yeah, well, what do you say to them? I'm interested in that. What would you say to them?
What I say is, yes, it is. You may have greater obstacles to overcome than I did. You may have the problem of a family that is not quite as together as mine was. Then you'll have to fight harder. You'll have to work harder. But don't give up. Don't lose faith in this society. It's the best on earth. You can accomplish it. You can still do it. But you've got to work. You've got to avoid the temptations that are there. You have got to get an education. You have to separate right from wrong and do what is right. And it doesn't take a government program to teach that to youngsters. It takes all of us reinforcing that in everything we do with young people and the message we convey on television and all the other messages we convey.
You say the Republican message to Black Americans seems to be lift ourselves by our bootstraps, but everybody doesn't have bootstraps. Some don't even have boots. And you write, I wish that Reagan and Bush had shown more sensitivity on this point. What would you say to Republican leaders today?
I say the same thing to them. It is fine to say that we should take the incentive away from welfare. And it is fine to say you've got to work hard. But I have seen youngsters in the inner city who just don't believe that hard work will do it anymore. They don't believe in the American dream. They have lost faith, and no amount of lecturing or changing of government programs will restore that faith. What we can't do is create an image that we have turned our back on these folks. And some of the rhetoric that is associated with the political revolution we're in now tends to suggest to these youngsters that we're turning our backs on them. That isn't what my Republican friends intend to do. They're committed to bettering the lives of these people. But we've got to watch the rhetoric. We've got to watch how we go about conveying that message to the American people.
So you think it's the rhetoric that's the problem, but not the policies?
I think we can. I can also, you know, debate some of the policies as well. And we can
name one.
Well, I think welfare reform. I think the suggestion that the only thing those poor unwed mothers need to get their lives together is to stop giving them cash payments for having another kid on their hip. I don't think the problem's that simple, and I don't think we should simplify it in that way. It is a far more fundamental problem than that, and so I think we have to be very, very careful if we do anything which ultimately punishes the child and not the unwed mother, because that child is the beginning of a farm system for all these jails we're going to need in about 15 years. And we have got to do something to make sure we do not penalize children as we go through this needed restructuring of the welfare system.
You urge President Clinton not to open up the military to gays. I'm wondering what your views are of including gays in civil liberties, in civil rights legislation. In other words, including gays in legislation about preventing job discrimination, housing discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation as well as race and gender. Would you want to see sexual orientation included in there?
I don't think that in terms of normal job opportunities within civilian society, which is quite different from military society, there should be discrimination on the basis of gender. I don't know what legislation is appropriate.
Gender or sexual orientation?
Or sexual orientation, which is sexual orientation. And I don't think there should be discrimination on that basis. But I think the military is unique and different. I don't know really what laws are required to protect that and whether that requires federal legislation or something that could be handled by the states or in municipalities. I am not sure, however, that I go so far as to suggest or think that we're at the point where that would include the recognition of marriage, and I'm still thinking about that. And with respect to permanent domestic relationships achieving some legal status, I'm still thinking about that one.
I have a last question for you. During the Gulf War, did you watch the war on television a lot?
Constantly.
Did that help you?
Yes, it did. In many cases, I got terrific information by watching what reporters were covering.
What did you get? What did you look? Yeah, what's
an
example?
Okay, and secondly, I had to watch it because of the American people watching it. I mean, it didn't rise to the level of the O.J. trial, but it was close to it.
Right.
I mean, you had a war being covered live that the whole world was watching in mm-hmm. real time. And sometimes you'd get a good information. You know, our information systems, our intelligence systems are good, but they rely very often on satellite photos looking down that come in hours late. And when you have three American reporters, very, very brave American reporters, in the person of Bernie Shore, John Holliman, and Peter Arnett sticking their heads out the window of the Rashid Hotel in Baghdad and telling you cruise missiles are going down the street, and when we have a CNN camera actually showing our cruise missiles going down the street, that is very, very useful information. And they also gave us insight as to what was happening in Baghdad among the population and with the leadership. Now, there were some days I was not happy with what I saw coming out of Baghdad when, for example, the baby milk factory is being examined by a reporter, and the Iraqis had even gone to the trouble of having brand-new baby milk factory smocks made for everybody to wear so that the camera can see in the back of the smock in English, baby milk factory, in case there was any confusion, whereas we were pretty sure that they were weapon facilities.
If you were still chair of the Joint Chiefs, would you want to fight another televised war?
You have no choice. I mean, in the current environment, all future conflicts are going to be televised conflicts. And so it's not a matter of not wanting it. It's a matter of understanding the media and understanding how we all have the same purpose, whether in the military or in the media, and that is to convey to the American people a sense of what their government is doing and what their young men and women in combat are being exposed to. Very often those two purposes is in tension from two different perspectives. I want to protect my secrets. The media want to put it out. But as long as we respect one another and recognize that the purpose is to inform the American people, it's a manageable situation.
General Powell, thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It was good to be with you.
And I'm going to give you one moment to reconsider about announcing whether you're going to run or not.
No, I've written it down. I've got you are one of the candidates.
That's right. We're going to be
you're
it.
A candidate. Now, in fact, you're the first one to ask that, so you certainly are first on the list.
Absolutely.
If not first in priority. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
All the best to your listeners.
Colin Powell's new autobiography is called My American Journey. His book doesn't reveal his political plans, but it does reveal his favorite films, which include the musicals Oklahoma, The Music Man, and Guys and Dolls. Here's a song from the cast recording of the recent revival on Broadway of Guys and Dolls.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's the guy that says if the weather's clear, can do. Can do. This guy says the horse can do. If he says the horse can do, can do, can do.
I'm picking Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9. But look at FS Hefty, waited by a half, according to this here is a telegraph.
For Paul Revere out bite, I hear his foot's all right. Of course it all depends if it rained last night.
I know it's Valentine, the morning marks look fine. Besides the jockey's brother's a friend of mine.
And just a minute, boys, I got the Phoenix noise. It's like his great-grandfather was terrible poised.
I tell you, Paul Revere, now this is no bum steer. It's from a handicap, but that's real sincere.
I go for Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
So make it happy, wait by a half, according to this here is a telegraph. Epitaph,
Valentine,
Paul Revere,
I got the horse.
The Fugue for Tin Horns from the recent Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. This is Fresh Air.